Let's sit. No more. Let's learn. Let's evolve. Let's talk. Today is Let's Talk Business with your host, Jai Lawton.
That's right, you are listening to Let's Talk Business. My name is Jai Lawton, a Bidjara man from Central West Queensland, and your host for the weekly Let's Talk Business series. Before we start, I would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands we broadcast here in West End and all across the country, wherever you are listening. I would like to acknowledge the unceded sovereignty of all First Nations people across the many nations in this continent and acknowledge all elders, past and present. Today, we are speaking to the current chairperson of AAA, Leanne Leving, who has also ventured onto starting a business of her own in recent times. Leanne has been around the business space for some time through various roles within QUT's business school, involvement with the Southeast Queensland Chamber of Commerce, and now the founder of Big Hill and Oyster as a counsellor, coach and consultant. Hello and welcome to the program, Leanne.
Hey, Jai. How are you doing?
Yeah, fantastic. And can we start with your mob and your country?
Yeah, sure. So through my dad's side, I have two ancestral bloodlines. One is Noongar, which is Moreton Island, and the other is Combermere, Gold Coast.
Yeah, cool. And let's start with AAA. You've been a board of director here for a number of years now, and for what we believe the first female chairperson in the organisation's history, can you tell us about your role as the chairperson of this organisation?
Yeah, thanks, Jai. So for a long time now, we have had some really deadly females on the AAA board. And it's maybe a little bit overdue that we've had a female step into the chair's role, but I feel really privileged to be the first female chair of AAA. You and I have spoken previously. There are just not enough female chairs of boards around the place. In Australia, we currently have only one chair of an ASX, so the Australian Stock Exchange, thousands and thousands of companies, and we only have one female chair. So, you know, this is a dream of mine that in years to come, we will have more and more female chairs to take on those board roles.
And while you're the first chair, I think the beautiful thing about our culture and this organisation, actually, when you look around, you know, is the natural breakup of diversity, you know, and you look at our senior leadership team and it's a rare thing to be outnumbered by women, which is such a deadly thing, which is the case within the senior leadership team here. And then you look around the board as well, and we're well represented and always have been. And we don't necessarily have a diversity inclusion policy. It's just the way of our business, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, speaking of the management team here that we've got, you asked about my role as chair for the organisation. You know, I feel really lucky to be in that chair's role, given the organisation has such a solid foundation and such a really strong history, including people in our management team who have been here for the entire 30 years, women who have been here for the entire 30 years. So it's a really exciting time to be involved with AAA, and particularly this year during for the 30-year anniversary.
Yeah, significant milestone for any organisation, and let alone, you know, a community-controlled organisation where, you know, the odds really are, and particularly previously against us, and we continue to thrive, and just as all of our other black media outlets do around the country. And in terms of your business journey, Leanne, and it's been far from linear. Can you share with the listeners about that journey into business?
Yeah, it has been far from linear. It's been very zigzaggy and spirally, and if we go back to the mid-90s, straight out of school, I went to study social work at UQ, but as an 18-year-old, that was pretty heavy stuff, particularly also coming from the background that I'd come from. And so I changed over to journalism and media, and did that at UQ. And while I was there through the Murray unit there at UQ, I got a cadetship. And so I worked with a corporate communications department for a number of years, went and worked with Land Rights Queensland newspaper in the late 90s there with Les Malzer, who's been one of our deadly campaigners and advocates globally. And, of course, Melissa Lukashenko, I worked with her, one of our deadly authors, worked with her at Land Rights Queensland.
Something in the water there at that time, eh?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So shout out to them. But then when I left there, I went overseas on a couple of years, you know, working holiday. And when I got back, I was absolutely broke, needed some cash, started work at a university here in Brisbane, 3 weeks casual job, and that was it. But 20 years later, I was still there. You know, one of the magic things about working for a university is its size, and the university was like a small town. You know, so many different departments, so many different divisions. I moved around quite a bit into different roles. You know, took the opportunity took any opportunity really to get more experience and to grow my skill set. So the experience that I got there was not just in terms of, you know, the on-the-job experience, but also the formal training that I was able to get while I was working at a university. So one of the benefits of working for a university was not just the training. You know, it was an excellent training ground, not only in terms of the experience that I got there, but also the formal education qualifications that I was able to do while I was there. So I was working for the library for a long time, and so I did a librarianship degree. And then more recently, I also did a leadership through coaching and mentoring, a postgraduate qualification, which has also contributed to where I am now. COVID hit. And the university got hit, and there was many of us, probably a couple of hundred of us, who were made redundant during that time, and I was one of them. And I took the opportunity, I used it, I saw it as an opportunity to finally move into a career that I thought was more purposeful, more meaningful for me, to be able to contribute back and make a difference in the world. And so I started studying a master's in narrative therapy and community work. Narrative therapy is a particular form of counselling. And so I did that through the University of Melbourne and through what's called the Dulwich Centre, which is essentially Australia's national centre for narrative therapy.
Tell us about how narrative therapy would differ from your normal type of therapy.
Yeah, so narrative therapy, so that word narrative is a fancy word for storytelling. And that's one of the reasons why I chose it, was because it's culturally appropriate for MOB. We've been telling stories for thousands of years. One of the things that we do differently is that we treat the person who has come to see us as the expert in their life. So we don't listen to the stories that they share with us, and we don't listen to their descriptions of their emotional experiences of life and put labels on them and say, oh, well, that's anxiety, that's depression, or that's PTSD, or, you know, these labels that, you know, might not mean anything to them, might also carry a load of other negative meanings that they then take on. And it also really, what we call, pathologizes them. You know, all of a sudden they're in that psychology, what's called the DSM, the Bible for psychology. So we listen to their stories, we honor their stories, their ways, their knowledges, their skills, their experiences, and through a range of, I guess, activities and approaches, we can help to guide them to recognize their own strong stories and to free themselves of those stories that, you know, been plenty, all of us MOB, we've been assigned negative stories before we were even born. And some of us, you know, go through life believing some of those stories about ourselves, and they're bullshit. So that's some of the differences with us and some other mental health modalities.
Yeah, I love that, because I think, you know, you look at that sort of stuff, and just a Western terminology or methodology will quickly try and define something then to treat something, and this sort of flips that completely on its head, doesn't it? And it's sort of, it's more based on our ways of knowing than the standard Western terminologies of therapy.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. And so Big Hill and Oyster, can you tell us about how that name came about and what it means?
Yeah. So narrative practice is all about story listening and storytelling and about stories. So, of course, there are a couple of stories behind the name. A couple of personal stories as well as some metaphors, which is why I chose that. So Big Hill is my grandfather's middle name. Mm. So his name was actually Kapimbar, his middle name, which Kapimbar is on Minjarabar. So it means Big Hill.
Yeah.
And that's Kapimbar is obviously Jandai language.
Yep.
For Kondamukamob, and that's where he was born, was on Big Hill on Kapimbar, on Minjarabar. But Big Hill I've also used as a bit of a metaphor for some of those obstacles and some of those challenges that we face in life. Mm. And then Oyster is important to me because during the early years of my life, I was brought up with Mob at a little place called Maribara. Sorry, not Maribara, directly east of Maribara. A little place called Bunuru, on the Great Sandy Strait overlooking Gari, Fraser Island, on Butchala country up there. And my grandfather and some of his siblings and their families had moved up there for the oyster leases.
Mm.
And so I was born into this family, this mob of oyster farmers. And that's what we did. And we'd, you know, drive around Maribara and sell, you know, bottled oysters. My mum and my big brother and everyone would be forever opening oysters. And the place would always smell of, you know, seafood and oyster shells. And yeah, so that was how I grew up.
I have to ask, do you eat oysters now after growing up around them?
I do now, Jai, but yeah. I didn't then. I absolutely hated oysters when I was a kid. Yeah, I just felt the sliminess and the big glugginess. I just hated it, couldn't stand it. And obviously the smell is pretty strong, I think, for a kid as well.
Yeah.
Absolutely love them now.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think in honour of our childhoods, my big brother always brings for Christmas, always brings all these oysters and seafood and prawns and bugs and a whole bunch of stuff.
Traditional or Kilpatrick?
Oh, I actually like them just natural with a squeeze of lemon juice and some black pepper.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah,
I'm a big oyster fan, actually.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Beautiful. Yeah, well, so my father was an oyster farmer. His father was an oyster farmer before Bunuru, before they had the oyster leases at Bunuru. My great-grandfather, so Gilbert Kapimbar's father, had, you know, the big cottage at Currajee down on South Stratty, and he was a bit of an oyster patriarch. You know, people would come and trade with him for a bucket of oysters.
Mm.
So, yeah.
So, growing up around a business family for a long time, really, when you think about it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we have been trading for thousands and thousands of years. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And just to add there, there's a third element within the Big Hill and Oyster. It's not in the name, but it's in the logo, and that's the waterline. Just showing you my business card there with you can see the waterline there, and that's a really important place between the Big Hill and the Oyster. And sorry, the metaphor for the Oyster too is those the gifts that we get from the challenges in life. You know, it's the rewards. And the great things, the learnings, the lessons that come from the challenges that we go through. But in the middle there, that waterline represents a really important place. It's between, in terms of physically, obviously it's between the land and the water. It's where the fresh water meets the salt water. It's the place where mobs would meet and feast and eat oysters. Mm. And our middens show that, particularly over on Minjarabar there. But it's also a place where it's a bridge between two worlds, two cultures. And that's really important for me in my whole approach to life because of the early experience that I had and then because of domestic violence and a parent with alcohol problem behaviours. Mm. My mum moved a couple of us kids away, and so I ended up, you know, moving way far away from Mob for many years, and came back as a teenager, lost my dad to alcohol, and so I've been really walking in these two worlds for many, many, many years, and this place in the middle I find is not a difficult place to be. I actually find it a really good place of connection and a place where people can come together and meet.
And I've spoken to a fair few people now on this business series program, and the thing that I found is that in any general business name, there might be a story to it or whatever, but in terms of Indigenous business and the names and the level of depth and sophistication is just on another level, and that just shows there now. If someone saw, you know, the name Big Hill and Oyster, they could draw some ties to, you know, to some symbolic stuff. But the way in which you've explained the depth and storytelling in that name is it's absolutely incredible.
Yeah, thanks, Jai. Yeah, it is a name that keeps me connected to my ancestors, to my culture, to place. So, yeah, and it was something that didn't, you know, I didn't labour over it. I didn't work at it and try to come up with something clever. It just came to me. It just seemed like such a natural thing. So I feel, yeah, really lucky in that regard.
Yeah, and can you share with us some of the different client bases that you work with in this space?
Yeah, so in terms of the counselling and coaching, I work with both individuals and with groups. Individuals, I find a lot of individuals come to me, well, there's lots of, you know, regular mental health issues that people have, but many of them do also have alcohol-related issues. And I think that's because some people know me, know my story. I've been very open and very public about the fact that I did have alcohol issues and how that was impacting on my life. I've been clean and sober now almost 8 years.
Yeah, wow.
So people know that, and so they will come and you know, seek out some counselling help. So it's really good to be able to say that, you know, there's some mob out there who, they feel better within themselves because of what I've been able to contribute and some of what I've learned during my experience. But narrative practice is also really powerful for groups and communities. Before I had Big Hill and Oyster, I was working for an Aboriginal counselling organisation, and we were going into prisons across Queensland, and I was co-facilitating an alcohol and other drugs program for incarcerated mob adults. And that was really powerful because of the narrative practice approach that we use. And having a group of, you know, 12, 15 mob in the room, having them to truly listen to each other, to be able to share their stories and truly listen to each other and truly feel heard when they're talking about their hopes and their dreams and their families and their values and all the things that are precious to them. And then reflecting back to them all of those amazing just stories of pride and culture, which is something they don't get to hear very often. So, yeah, that was a really, obviously not a positive experience for, you know, the levels of incarceration of our mob that we have to face, but it's good that someone was in there.
Yeah, and creating that level of healing and you know, creating avenues and to tell their stories, I think, is a powerful thing. And their stories are often predefined or they're predetermined, and to be able to crack down into those layers, I think, would have been really powerful for them.
Yeah, it really is. And to work with them to the point where they get to, you know, you can see some of them have that light bulb moment where they realise, shit, these are not my stories. They're not mine. No. I didn't come up with them. I'm getting rid of them. I'm going to write my own stories from here on.
Yeah, and this place and position they're in now shouldn't define them either.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Another example, Joy, if I can, working with community was when I was working with the a Yuggera mob out Ipswich Way, Wirinya Land Conservation Services. And I think you've had the MD, Linda Maybanks.
Linda, yeah, yep.
Yeah, on here too. So Linda wanted to strengthen and grow Wirinya. And so working together, we put together a bit of a narrative practice program that went over about 12 weeks. We got the mob together one night a week. Of course, there were a few weeks there when we couldn't make it because State of Origin was on and, you know, that sort of stuff.
Other priorities.
Exactly. But so based on some of those narrative practice ideas and activities, we would yarn together, you know, that sometimes there was, you know, a dozen of us, and we would yarn, and that individual yarning about ourselves with one another would help to contribute to strengthening not only ourselves as individuals, but also the group. And so as a business, as a family business, and as a growing kinship business, Woodinya was able to, sort of strengthen, become a bit stronger. In fact, we call the program Woodinya Stronger, because Woodinya means coming back.
Yeah,
so, and they were, you know, restoring traditional ways, so coming back stronger. So that was just, another example.
No, it sounds like you're doing some great work with some great people. And if you have just tuned in, you are listening to Let's Talk Business, where we are talking all things Indigenous business with our guest today, Leanne, the founder of Big Hill and Oyster and the current chairperson of AAA. Leanne, as a startup business, can you share with us some of the challenges in starting up a business?
Some of the things... for me that I found, and maybe it was because I worked for a big organisation, you know, a big university where, you know, if you need someone to pay an invoice, you call the finance department. If you need another staff member, you call the HR department, or you call the marketing department. Or when you start as a small micro business, you have to do all of that yourself.
Yeah.
There's no HR department to call. So that was tricky, or is tricky. And probably the costs as well, just the costs of a startup just add up, you know, from paying for the website, the domain name and the website build and the printing of signage and spending time looking for somewhere, you know, a premises to work from, then paying the rent for that place, or if you're lucky enough, you know, buying a place. So marketing. It all adds up. So there are quite a few startup costs that I think I might have underestimated a little bit. So that was a bit of a challenge. And marketing. I think one of the things I have found really difficult is marketing. I'm not someone who likes to be in the spotlight. I'm not someone who likes to self-promote. But it seems as though in 2023, if you want to have a small business, you have to have a presence on social media. You can't rely on word of mouth alone. And so that is something that I'm still learning. Not great, and still, we're still growing confidence in that social media and marketing space.
That's all right. There might be some tricks here that some of the mob around the building might be able to help you out
Excellent.
With.
Excellent. Great.
Yeah, and it is. It's the starting up a business and you don't know what you don't know, right? And I think that's sort of... there are those hidden things that just come along, and it's not always easy starting up a business, but you know, there's multiple benefits as well. And on the tail end of COVID, Leanne, like, self-care has been such a big focus, particularly with our mob and working with our mob in the Indigenous space. And, you know, we talk about burnout. That's been a big factor in workplaces and just life generally. Do you see this frequently with the work that you do in the space that you work in?
Yeah, for sure. You know, even with that, you know, I was talking about the work in prisons, you know, during COVID, that all stopped. We couldn't go in there, and they weren't allowed to have visitors. And, you know, they wouldn't dare cough or, you know, have a runny nose, because they'd be put into ISO straight away, you know, on the suspected COVID basis.
Yeah.
But COVID changed lots of lives. You know, many Indigenous businesses went out of business and couldn't survive. Many Indigenous businesses just had to suddenly change their business model and really quickly to do that. Some people, many people lost their jobs.
Yep.
I was one of them, as I mentioned. And these things all bring stress and pressure. That is going to affect our ability to be able to self-care. But I think COVID aside, self-care is something that has always been really important for mob. You know, if we have a look at our health outcomes, the gap in our health outcomes, rates of suicide amongst our young people, the racial violence that we face, the relentless judgments on our identity. These are all factors that contribute to our mental health and our capacity to be able to self-care. As we talked about, we were born into these stories about Aboriginal people and what we are, what we're supposed to be. That is all bullshit. And for me, one of the biggest, strongest, loudest protests that we can make is through self-care. By standing up and saying, I am worthy of taking care of myself.
Yep.
By being healthy and looking after our bodies. By being strong and looking after our minds. By looking after each other. Having thriving families and communities. One of my fellow therapists in the States, Billy Dubbery, his name is, he works with Indigenous gangs over there. And he's had a lot of success working with what he calls lateral empathy as a counter to the lateral violence that he has seen in his communities. So, you know, with kindness and with love and joy and laughter and with living the way that we want our kids to be able to live, you know, there's power in that. There's power in choosing the way that we want to be able to live. And I think that's our right. That's part of our self-determination. And we need to claim that regardless of how the system treats us.
So important.
Actually, if I can add to that, Jai, you know, one of the very topical and current things here that we're talking about is the voice to parliament. And voice to parliament or not, the outcome is not going to heal us. It's not going to change our experience. No one's coming to save us and do our healing for us. We need to do that ourselves. Voice to parliament or not, we need to heal from within. We need to heal ourselves and we need to heal our communities from within our communities. It's nothing coming from outside that's going to change it. Yes, of course, it's going to be, it would make a difference for all of our lives if we didn't have to face that marginalisation and that oppression every day that we do. But we still need to take those steps ourselves for our own personal healing and our own well-being and to really, you know, it's that self-care, looking after ourselves.
And it starts with us.
It starts with us.
Yeah.
It starts with us. Our culture is based on community. You know, we don't have to do it alone. Our culture is based on community and our collective healing we can do together.
Yeah, some powerful words there, Leanne. And we've spoken about the challenges in the startup space, but let's look at the sector as a whole. What are some of the challenges that we face right now as an Indigenous business sector?
Yeah, I think we're booming. The Indigenous business sector is booming, but we're still young, relatively young. And so I think we don't have that intergenerational wealth behind us. We don't have that intergenerational business knowledge and business know-how. You know, we've been trading forever, for thousands of years, but in terms of operating in this Western economy, this Western business model, we're just learning that now. And with that, over time, will come more knowledge and more skills in terms of financial management. You know, we'll be passing on those skills to our kids and our business knowledges to our kids. So we're playing catch up right now, but I think we're going to definitely have a huge presence in the future if we continue the way we are.
Yeah, and you mentioned earlier there around, you know, the intergenerational wealth, and, you know, we have been locked out of the economy, so it's hard to, and you talk about your startup costs as well, like it's hard to generate and accumulate wealth when our mob have been locked out of the economy and don't have, you know, assets or, you know, or haven't been privy enough to be able to build that over time.
Yeah, for sure. I think also we want to have healthy communities and healthy mobs so that we can have as many people working in our Indigenous businesses as we can.
Mm.
When I talk to Indigenous businesses, they all want mob. They're all looking for mob to come and work.
Mm.
We just don't have enough. You know, in every single sector, we've got businesses, Indigenous businesses now in every single industry, every single sector, and everyone wants mob to go and work with them.
Mm.
But we just struggle to find Indigenous people to employ.
Yeah.
I think sometimes too the you know, there's a clash of values because we are community minded, and with the Western economy that we operate in and Western business model, it's not about, you know, community and collectivism.
Mm.
It's about individualism and capitalism and making as much money as you possibly can. And, you know, there's still that shame that comes with, you know, you can't be a black fella and have lots of money. So, you know, we've got to get rid of that. And we know the more money we have, the more we put back into our Indigenous economy. You know, we spend it on Indigenous businesses. We spend it on Indigenous-made products and services, and it goes back into our economy and strengthens our communities. So, you know, we can get rid of that shame around having money. We deserve to make money as much as anybody.
Yeah, and you brought up some good points there around, you know, some future-based stuff, and I ask this question to all of my guests, but I do want to transport you in time to 50 years from now. So the year is 2073. What does Indigenous business look like?
2073. I'll be turning 100 that year, Jai.
100?
100.
There you go.
And AAA will be turning 80 that year as well.
Mm.
Well, that's a very big question, and as chair of AAA, our strategic planning certainly hasn't looked that far ahead. You know, I think the big thing will be technology. You know, if we think about the past 30 years and AAA's history, the internet was barely even, you know, certainly wasn't common 30 years ago. Obviously, just starting up. But wow, you know, how much have we been able to do in 30 years? So in 50 years from now, I think there's going to be technologies that we can't even yet imagine. We've got no idea, you know, what sort of impact they might have on the way we work and live. So I think technology is going to be the big thing. But certainly within the media sector, I think, you know, with the solid history that AAA has in another, you know, 50 years from now, we're still going to be here. We'll still be sharing our stories our way. We'll still be, you know, providing that unique blend of country and Indigenous music here at AAA.
Scary to think what country music's going to be like in 50 years. It's evolved so rapidly over the last, you know, 5-6 years and or a decade, argue. But, it's exciting times. And what do you think that the Indigenous business will look like beyond the media sector?
Well, I do think, you know, again, because of the boom that we're seeing now, I think it's just going to be business as usual in 50 years. We will have had, you know, but that's our children and our grandchildren from my generation. You know, they will just be business owners, and we will have started accruing some of that intergenerational wealth and some of those skills needed to operate in this Western economy. So I think it's going to be, yeah, business as usual, and we won't be, it won't be so so difficult. But even now, I've got to say, even now, and you mentioned this earlier, Jai, there are so many deadly mentors around in this, in Indigenous business. So for anyone who's thinking about starting up and in their own business, just do it and reach out to people. And yes, plenty of mentors around, plenty of willing mentors who are happy to help and guide people.
Yeah, that have been there and done it.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. They're all around. And finally, Leanne, where can people find you to get in touch to access your services from Big Hill and Oyster?
Yeah, so I'm still growing my social media presence,
yeah.
But I am Big Hill and Oyster on Facebook and Instagram. But probably the best place to go, the easiest place to go, is my website, which is bighill-oyster.com.au.
All right, so all you mob make sure you get out there and you follow those social links and jump on the website and check it out even further. I just want to thank you very much for coming onto the program today, Leanne, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jai. Thanks for having me. Been a pleasure.
No, not a worry. And you have been listening to Let's Talk. If you want to hear more from today or catch another episode of Let's Talk, make sure you head over to the website at aaa.org.au. Thank you.
No more whispering in our mind. Let's Talk, Monday to Friday at 9 a.m. on AAA Murray Country, the National Indigenous Radio Service and iHeartRadio. You can catch up on aaa.org.au, proudly supported by the Community Broadcast Foundation.